Thank you, Shira, and thank you to the organizers at Torah in Motion. Thanks to all of you for taking the time from all over the world to join us today and explore the world of Second Temple Judaism, specifically through the eyes of some incredible women who are relatively unknown. Usually when I teach, or at least lately when I've been teaching, I've been focusing on literature and on the representation of women in Jewish writings that were produced primarily from the second century BCE through the first century CE. And unfortunately, there is often a chasm between scholars who study literature and scholars who study history through the material world, the cultural world, archaeology. And today I am going to dive into Jewish literature, but to try to suss out and find some historical kernels to better understand the world behind the literature and the world that Jews knew in the first century BC and first century CE, which featured some pretty incredible women. Before we dive into these sources, I do want to let you know that I will probably not be checking the chat until the second half of the class. If you have a question for clarity, I think that you can unmute yourselves and jump in and say, "You said that too fast. I don't understand you." One time, someone gave me feedback that I sound like the side effects that are said at the end of a medication commercial. So no metaphors necessary. If you need me to repeat myself, I can do that. And if you do have questions or comments that can wait, please put those in the chat towards the end of the hour. And so we're going to begin with a few comments about the Hasmonean period, which lasts from 164 BCE to 63 BCE, exactly a century. I think that today, especially in an age where we have an independent state, however you feel about Israeli politics certainly is not for today's class. But we often, I think, especially those of us who have had a day school Jewish education, have a kind of a romanticized view of the Hasmonean period. We imagine, you know, a group of, okay, I'm just going to move the chat. Thank you. A group of, you know, independent, very pious, very committed Jews who wanted to preserve the integrity of their ancestral tradition, and they rebel against the, you know, big bad king Antiochus IV Epiphanes. Very often we kind of see ourselves through the experience of the Hasmoneans. We use symbols from this period to talk about our own support for the state of Israel often. But the question of the legacy of the Hasmonean period and its leaders is not only contested right after that period is over, but even contested while it's happening. In other words, Jews who are living under Hasmonean rule really struggle with the question of its legacy, of whether it should be supported. And great historians and writers, such as the late first century CE historian Josephus and the early rabbis, are incredibly ambivalent about this period. Why? Why do these thinkers, Josephus, the rabbis, and others feel so ambivalent, feel so unclear about how to assess this period of, you know, incredible independence in this huge Hellenistic world where it would have been so shocking and remarkable that the Jews defeated the Syrian Greeks? A part of the reason has to do with how the Hasmonean period ends in 63 BCE. The period ends in a way where I think many Jews felt it was utterly preventable. You may have heard of a king named Alexander Janneus, Alexander Yanai, who is considered to be a horrible villain in the rabbi's imagination. Well, not the, I mean, I don't say imagination like they're making it up, but in rabbinic literature, they remember Alexander Yanai and the horrible persecution that Pharisees and other Jews suffered under his rule in the early first century BCE. When Alexander Janneus Yanai dies, he leaves his kingdom over to his wife, Salome Alexandra. We're going to look at literature that talks about her legacy and her life very soon. And he leaves the kingdom over to her. Her approach towards how to deal with non-Hellenized Jews in the kingdom is very different than her husband's. She tries to make peace with the Pharisees. She initiates overtures to unite the people. The Pharisees, as we will see, love her, and so do the rabbis who come later. But in many ways, she is not a strong leader, or perhaps you might say she is not a strong mother. Salome Alexandra has two sons, Aristobulus and Hyrcanus. They are very different personalities, and they also have very different attitudes towards how to envision the future of the Hasmonean kingdom. Aristobulus is a pro-Hellenizer who really wants to bring Judea into the modern world and sort of dissolve the boundaries that are, you know, again, imagined, conceived around the land of Israel, of Judea. And Hyrcanus would have aligned himself more with the Pharisaic approach to preserve the exceptionalism of the land of Israel and to preserve the integrity of the people's ancestral laws. Aristobulus rebels against his mother and tries to we don't know that he tries to assassinate her, but certainly tries to take over the kingdom while she's still alive. Hyrcanus gets involved to defend his mother and to wrest the kingdom back from Aristobulus. What, of course, happens is a civil conflict in the 60s BCE. And I'll just say as an aside, this period really is not commemorated in Jewish history in any way. So many Jews just don't know about it. We kind of know about Hanukkah, right? Although I don't know that your average Jew can exactly describe the circumstances in which the conflict took place. We kind of know Purim, although that's even harder to date. Really, we don't know when Purim happened. So good luck with that. But, you know, early Second Temple period, Persian period, of course. But this civil conflict between Aristobulus and Hyrcanus is one of the most significant turning points for Jews in the ancient world. Because when they both appeal to Rome to support their side, Rome says, oh, this is a great opportunity to capitalize on Jewish weakness and just invade, right? Why would we side with Hyrcanus or Aristobulus when we can harness the weakness of this internal strife, which, by the way, does parallel what happens in 175 BCE when Antiochus Epiphanes goes in and enacts all these edicts that prohibit the observance of ancestral law. The reason why, one of the reasons why it's effective is because there is intra-Jewish fighting and discord. All right, going back to 63 BCE, Rome takes the opportunity to invade Jerusalem, and there's a general Pompey, not the city, P-O-M-P-E-Y, who invades Jerusalem, and tens of thousands of Jews are killed. This is a massive disaster, and this is the end of the Hasmonean period, which ends in death, which ends in suffering, destruction, physical destruction, and it's also the beginning of Roman occupation. And so when Jews at the end of the first century BCE and the first century CE are looking back on the Hasmonean period, I don't know that they're remembering those early years of Judah Maccabee running through the Judean wilderness. By the way, First Maccabee says that he's forcibly circumcising Jews. We don't have to imagine that too much. But I don't know that these Jews are thinking about the early stages of this heroism and valor. They might have been thinking about the last moments of the Hasmonean monarchy, which were moments of horrible bloodshed. And so we have, again, figures like Josephus, who are very, very critical of those later Hasmonean leaders. And what I want to talk about today is little beacons of light that show up beginning in the end of the Hasmonean period, all the way through the end of the Second Temple period. So from around, from the 70s, I'm just going to address questions later. And I don't think that that's the same Pompey. So all the way from the 70s BCE to 73 CE, you have little beacons of light. And these beacons are associated with female rulership. And so we're going to talk about three such women. I have a thumbs up from Deb, but I don't know why. Or you just like that beacons of light come from women. So me too. I like that too. Two thumbs up, right? So we're going to talk about three of these women. We're going to focus on Alexandra Janaeus' wife, Salome Alexandra, also known in the rabbinic imagination as Shlomtzion Hamalkah. And Shlomtzion reigned from 76 to 67 BC. And I think that she gets a very bad rap. And I am here to defend her. Because if you read what Josephus says about Salome Alexandra, I'll call her Salome, but remember, she's the same person as Shlomtzion if you read rabbinic texts. If you look at what Josephus says about her, you will think she's weak and she's manipulatable and she you know, she allows the country to enter the brink of ruin, because she can't stop Aristobulus, and she lets everyone who encounters her control her. I mean, these would have been tropes that would have been familiar to many readers, Jewish or not, in the ancient world, when it comes to, you know, female weakness, and ruling with emotions. And, Josephus has a lot to say about, Salome Alexandra, and I want to, take another look at her legacy. We're also going to look at a Herodian princess named Berenike, Bernice. Now, remember that from 63 BCE, that's the beginning of Roman occupation, but Judea is not fully incorporated into the Roman Empire until 6 CE. So what's happening between 63 BCE and 6 CE? Judea is kind of a Herodian client kingdom. Herod, very famously, but I'll start with Herod's father, Antipas, sometimes known as Antipater, is ruling Judea, but he's not a Judean. He's an Idumean. He comes from the east, from Edom. And the Idumeans were known to have converted to Judaism in the early Hasmonean period, but because some of them converted under pressure to Judea, to Judaism, and again, what does conversion mean? Don't ask me. I don't know what it means in the second century BC, but okay, they became Jews. They started acting, observing as Jews. But they were not really trusted by local Jews, who looked upon these Idumeans with suspicion, and absolutely looked at Antipater and his son Herod and their family with incredible suspicion, and for good reason. Many of us know the legacy of Herod, which was not a very nice legacy. Murdering your wife and her entire family is not a way to enter into, you know, the family tree. Some might say that that's not the best impression one could make, drowning your wife's little brother in a pool. Anyway, I was making light of Herod and I lost track. So Berenike is a descendant of this Herodian family. And she, and because the Hasmoneans and the Herodians are marrying each other, remember, Herod marries Miriam, who the rabbis say he murdered and then saved her in honey. Remember, he preserves her in honey because he kills her and then he wants to preserve her. So it's a little creepy, but Berenike is a descendant of both of these families in the middle of the first century, and she rules alongside her brother Agrippa too. These two are actually mentioned in the New Testament, but Berenike becomes very notorious and also very unpopular. She's unpopular among Romans. And the reason why the Romans hate Berenike is because she has a little love affair with Titus. Maybe we Jews should hate her too, because we don't like Titus. Remember, Titus is part of the Flavian family, who is responsible for the destruction of Jerusalem and the fall of the temple in 70 CE. So now we have another woman who is not remembered very positively, and I'm here to bring her back to you and tell you that Berenike is, she's great. Now we get to our third friend, Helena of Adiabene. Helena of Adiabene is unique. Or at least she's distinct from Shlomzion, from Salome Alexandra, and Berenike. Helena of Adiabene is not Jewish, or she's not born Jewish. She's born as a Persian queen. And we have sources from Josephus and the rabbis who tell us that Helena and her son converted to Judaism. Again, we're not going to discuss what that meant because I do not know. And I don't know that we can discern what that would have meant to convert to Judaism at this time, but they convert, and she becomes an incredible benefactor of the construction or the development of the land of Israel in the first century. And today you can go to Israel and you can find, I think that there's a street named after her, and there are even archaeological sites that are associated with palaces that she built. And she had an incredible imprint on the development of Jerusalem and those environs. But although she, as far as we know, did not live there full time, but she visited. And the reason why Helena is distinct, besides the fact that culturally she comes from a different, sort of a different world, is that Helena is beloved by all who write about her. So whatever source you find about Helena, if someone gives you $10 million or whatever it was, you'll also like her. But Helena seems to have been truly a very a very great friend of the Jewish people. And yes, there's also, and someone just private messaged me, there's also a street named Dr. Shlomo Zion Malka. I know that street very well. All right. So is there a street named Dr. Berenike? Someone needs to do something about that because there really should be. So we are just going to dive right in with our limited time. And again, just to review before I share my screen, when it comes to Salome Alexandra, we probably will spend most of our time on her. Josephus does not praise her. He feels like she was responsible for the dissolution of the Hasmonean Empire. The rabbis love Shlom Tzion Malka. I'm going to ask Constantine is much later. Helena's first century, but save questions for the end if you don't mind. Thank you so much. Unless it's a clarity question. Berenike is not mentioned in rabbinic literature, as far as I know. Maybe they considered her to be an assimilated member of the Herodian family. Maybe they did not know her or they didn't know of her. Again, she's notorious for having a love affair with Titus. That seems to have been true, that she did have an affair with him. So maybe the rabbis did not view her as pious or, you know, deserving of being part of the their, you know, memories of the first century, but Josephus loves Berenike, which is interesting. Josephus praises her and admires her piety. The Roman historians are the ones who bash Berenike. So both Salome and Berenike are on the receiving end of significant critique, which I will call in modern parlance, very gendered. They suffer from maybe being subject to expectations that their male counterparts would not have been subject to. And yet Helena is just the darling of them all. So now we are going to look at some sources, and I'm going to start with Shlom Tzion Malka. Because I have to finish, I guess I should finish at around, I'm in Chicago, I'm an hour behind New Yorkers. I'm going to try to finish at in a half an hour, maybe 12:05, 12:10. And if Shira, that's an issue, I think this class is an hour. I'm working on that assumption. All right, so let's share the screen. Okay, this is the part, this is the hardest part of the class, finding the, all right, let's see if this is the right document. Do you see? Okay. I'm going to assume that you all see this, but I would appreciate some thumbs up. You see? Okay, thank you. Thank you, Art 613. Okay, thank you, David Patrick. All right. So we, so I always include a little timeline. If you've taken my classes before, you know this timeline very well. But here I have taken the liberty of inserting my friends. Salome Alexandra reigns from 76 to 67 BCE. And then the time in between 67 to 63, this is a tumultuous time of contested rule between Hyrcanus and Aristobulus, her two sons. And then over here I have Berenike, who's born in around 28 CE. Oh, I also have a Herodian family tree. Ooh, but that's in a different document. So maybe in the Q&A, I'll share you an image of the Herodian. It is so complicated, the Herodian family tree. But you can find charts. You can find flow charts of varying qualities online. It's very, very confusing, especially because half of these people are named Miriam, Herod, or Agrippa. And then we have Helena. We don't know the date of her birth, but we think it's around 30 CE. We think the date of her conversion is 30 CE. And she dies in the middle of the first century. We don't have her dates. We just have estimation. All right. So let's start with Josephus. Now, if I had 2 hours or if this was a series, we would do this line by line. But maybe to your great relief, we are not going to do this line by line. Now, I'm just going to paint with broad strokes over here. When Alexander Janaeus dies, Salome Alexandra turns to the Pharisees and tries to make peace with them. Alexander Janaeus notoriously did many horrible things to the Pharisees, among them crucified 800 Pharisees in front of their wives and children. He was considered to be a very, very cruel and ruthless leader who wanted to force a break between the people and their ancestral traditions and sort of forcibly Hellenize them. And Alexandra is just of different stuff. She wants to pacify the Pharisees. And you would think that Josephus, who says in his autobiography that he identified with the Pharisees, you'd think that he would praise her for this. But instead, he critiques Salome Alexandra for allowing the Pharisees to control her. So before we get to that, he says Alexander left two sons, Hyrcanus and Aristobulus, but he committed the kingdom to his wife. Already, that's interesting. I think most of my Catholic students have no idea that we have Judean queen of the Hasmonean monarchy for 9 years, and she actually militarily was a success. No one argues that, by the way. We have no source that says Alexandra was a poor military leader. She secures the borders of her kingdom. She's a terrible leader at the end, you know, when everything falls apart, but she does strengthen the borders of the kingdom, and Josephus admits that. Now, Hyrcanus, one son, he's unable to manage public affairs. He delights in a quiet life. These are sort of very, you know, broad generalizations Josephus is painting, but okay. The younger Aristobulus is an active and bold man. And Alexandra herself, she's loved by the multitude. You might remember if you heard me say this, and I actually gave a class. Who was I teaching on Monday? I don't remember. I'm on sabbatical. I had no expectation of teaching at all this year, but somehow I'm teaching every day. I don't remember who I was teaching on. Anyway, so I was just talking to another group about how the Pharisees controlled the multitude. That's in another part of Josephus. So if Josephus says that the Pharisees controlled the multitude and Alexandra is loved by the multitude, then you have to make the connection between the alliance between Alexandra and the Pharisees. There is a street Berenike in Katamon. Wow, that's a relief, because I was going to try to do some recon. So all three women have a road namesake. That's great to know. Okay. All right. So she knows that her sons are two very different people. So she gives them different roles. She makes Hyrcanus the high priest because he didn't want to meddle in politics. But she also permits the Pharisees to do everything, and she makes the multitude be obedient. Again, I don't know that that's so fair of Josephus when elsewhere he says that the multitude of people in Judea choose to follow the Pharisees. Here she says she's ordering them to be obedient to the Pharisees, but you get the point. She's restoring the Pharisaic practices according to the tradition of their forefathers, and which her father-in-law, Alexander Janneus, John Hyrcanus, had abrogated. And so she's giving the Pharisees more power than they had had in generations. And she increases her own army. She becomes terrible to the neighboring tyrants. Here, I actually don't know that that's an insult. I think that he's saying that she is, you know, here he says she put the country entirely at peace, except for the Pharisees. They disturbed the queen because they were always trying to control her, and they were pressuring her. What? How? They were pressuring her to kill those supporters of her husband, her now deceased husband, who conspired with Alexander Janneus to kill the 800 men. In other words, the Pharisees have enemies, and they're pressuring Salome Alexandra, to kill those enemies, even though she has made peace with them. And she's the most powerful person in the monarchy, but the Pharisees want revenge. And Josephus does not like this. Josephus does not praise the Pharisees for putting pressure on the queen. And they insist that the queen give them certain positions in the kingdom. And, you know, towards the end of her decade of reign, she is really under their thumb. Now, at the same time, her own son is criticizing her, Aristobulus, who, like his father, is a sympathizer with Hellenizers. Her own son is criticizing his mother for allying with the Pharisees. Is this confusing? Do I need to slow down? We have, okay, good, thank you. We have, on the one hand, Alexander Janneus and his son Aristobulus and their supporters who are pro-Hellenizers. And then we have their antagonists, the Pharisees, Salome Alexandra, and her son Hyrcanus. And Aristobulus, the son, is very disrespectful to his mother. And he says that they themselves, in other words, Salome Alexandra, were the authors of their own calamities. He says to his mother, you created your own problems with the Pharisees being mean to you or pressuring you to kill their enemies, because you and also the Pharisees have allowed a woman mad with ambition. Remember, he's saying this to his mother, to reign over them. Now, Alexandra doesn't know what to do, and so she's giving over property to Aristobulus. Now, what this culminates in is a civil conflict between Aristobulus and his mother, and then Aristobulus and his brother, Hyrcanus. Again, they both appeal to Rome for support. Rome comes in and invades. I don't want to go through that whole story because I want to stay focused on the legacy of Salome Alexandra. You can read this on your own. But I want to focus on how Josephus remembers her. All right, I see more questions in the chat. We're so, yes. Okay, that's good. And yes, please slow down. I'm going to really try to slow down. This is how Josephus remembers Salome Alexandra at the end of Antiquities. Okay, she dies after 9 years, 76 to 67 BC are the years of her reign. She's 73, nice long life. As a woman, she showed no signs of the weakness of her sex. Okay, that might be sort of a half compliment, but she was sagacious to the greatest degree in her ambition. And we see this trope about Salome Alexandra being inappropriately ambitious, wanting more power than she is entitled to. I do think this is a typical critique of powerful women then and now. And she demonstrated by her doings at once that her mind was fit for action. All right, this isn't so bad, but it gets worse. That sometimes men show the little understanding they have by the frequent mistakes they make in point of government. Okay. She always preferred the present to the futurity. In other words, and I think he might be right about this in the sense that she didn't see the long-term effects of not choosing one of her sons over the other. She tried to make peace between them and she tried to pacify the Pharisees, but she didn't have the long-term strategy to maintain, to choose and maintain a successor. She preferred the power of an imperious dominion above all things. And here again, he criticizes her for being ambitious. She brought the affairs of her house to such an unfortunate condition that she was the occasion of the taking away that authority from it. And do you see what he's doing here? He is blaming her for the invasion of Rome. He is blaming her for Roman occupation. He might even be blaming her for the loss of the temple. This is a huge accusation. She brought the affairs of her house to such an unfortunate condition that she was the occasion of taking that authority away from it. Forget Aristobulus. Right? And Hyrcanus, it's the fault of Salome Alexandra. Oh my gosh. So that, where was I? She, okay. In no long time afterwards, she had obtained by vast number of hazards, this out of a desire of what does not belong to a woman. I really hope that you don't all come away from this talk hating Josephus, but you know, if you feel a little uncomfortable, I sympathize. And all by a compliance in her sentiments with those that bear ill will to her family. Okay. Indeed, her management during her administration while she was alive was such as filled the palace after her death with calamities. All right, we get the point, Josephus. Although this had been her way of governing, she preserved the nation in peace. Okay, so, you know, on the one hand, especially in the at the outset of her kingdom, she preserves the, she secures the borders from neighboring threats. But because she doesn't solve the affairs that are taking place in her own house, calamity ensues. And she dies, you know, with the distress, knowing that there is no successor and she has brought Rome to her doorstep. Now, this is in Antiquities. Josephus writes four works. He writes the autobiography Vita. He writes Against Appian, the first systematic defense of the Jewish religion to ever be produced. He writes the 20-volume work Antiquities, and that's what this passage is from. I realize that when I point, you're not actually seeing. I have to raise my hand to point. I'm pointing. And then he writes a 7-volume recollection of the war called the Jewish War. This is the war, of course, against the rebellion of the Judean people against Roman rule that takes place from 66 to 73 CE. And in this work too, he talks about Salome Alexandra. Why would there be any reference to Salome Alexandra in the Jewish War if he's talking about 66 to 73 CE? The answer to that is because according to Josephus, it starts with her, right? According to Josephus, the entire conflict with Rome begins in the early first century BCE. It starts with the weakening Hasmonean Empire. It starts with conflicts sown by Alexander Janaeus and then never resolved by Salome Alexandra. And so if you see this is book one of 7 books, he really starts way, 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 way before 66 CE. He's holding the family responsible for Roman occupation. And what does he say about Salome Alexandra in this treatise? Again, it's much, much shorter. We're only going to look at a little bit. Okay, so again, Salome Alexander left the kingdom to Alexandra, his wife, and the Pharisees joined themselves to her. And here he explains who they are. He also does this in books 13 and 18 of Antiquities. And here he says, there's a certain sect of the Jews that appear more religious than others. So that's, I think that appears doing very heavy lifting in the sentence. They seem to interpret the laws more accurately. And Alexandra hearkened to them to an extraordinary degree. Again, she's controlled. She's ambitious and she's easily controlled. Those are the two themes that we, I like the comments coming in, that we keep seeing when it comes to descriptions of her. The Pharisees artfully insinuate themselves into her favor little by little, and they become the real administrators of the public affairs. They banish and reduce whom they please. In other words, they're promoting and they're demoting and they're arresting and they're releasing. And to say all at once, they had the enjoyment of the royal authority. In other words, they're really controlling the situation while the expenses and the difficulties of it belong to Alexandra. So maybe he feels a little bit bad for her. Again, she was a sagacious woman in the management of great affairs. I know I have to slow down. Maybe you could listen to the recording at like half speed, because when I get excited, it's just very hard to slow down. But let's look at these last few lines, then we'll move on to the Talmud. She increased the army by one half. She procured a great body of troops. That's all praiseworthy, according to Josephus, till her own nation became not only very powerful at home, but also to foreigners. But while she governed other people, look at those last five lines, five words, the Pharisees governed her. And that's the legacy of Salome Alexandra in the mind of Josephus. How do we feel about this? A little angsty. But you will be happy to find out that the rabbis do not have this kind of ambivalence when it comes to her legacy. In fact, it's very, very praiseworthy, except they don't always mention her where she perhaps deserves mention. And I want to point you to just one, two little sources. Don't slow down. You know, I'm going to stop looking at the chat. Two sources that parallel one another in rabbinic literature. And I'm going to do the later source first. This is from Megillat Tani. And to understand what's going on here, you have to know that that Shimon ben Shetach, who was remembered by the rabbis as a Pharisee, a proto-rabbi who was one of the men of the Great Assembly and a great leader who transmitted the oral tradition mentioned in the Mishnah and Avot. So here, keep that in mind as you read this. I'll read the English because we have a lot of people on the call. So we found in the days of Shimon ben Shetach that rain invariably fell for the people on Wednesday evening, and Shabbat evening. I actually think Wednesday evening, but anyone can correct me, but I actually think this means Tuesday night and Friday night. And it was at these times, there are other traditions that we know that there was fear of demonic forces that were thought to wander the streets on Tuesday nights. And on Friday night, maybe people also did not go out because of the sanctity of Shabbat. But it was on Tuesday night and on Friday night that there was always rain. And this is a sign of divine blessing. We know that from the Hebrew Bible, that rain is a sign of divine blessing, but only rain in its time, right? If rain comes at the wrong time, then it's a curse. Or if there's too much rain. But here, the rain is coming at the right times because people are not going out. And the rain is so perfect and, reflective of divine pleasure with the people that wheat grew as big as kidneys and barley as big as olive pits and lentils as golden dinars. So huge, giant fruit pieces. I don't know how to, I'm losing my words today. All right. And so this is a sign of divine pleasure. All right, I'm going to end there because who's missing? Who's missing from this? The days of Shimon ben Shetach. Well, let me show you a parallel verse. This is an earlier text. Well, it's hard to date, but look at this midrashic tradition from Vayikra Rabbah, which might preserve an older version of this tradition. So again, this is an interpretation of a biblical verse. Natati gishmichem bi'itam. I will give you your rains in the proper time. What does that mean? It means that in certain evenings. Okay, and if you compare, you can see this is interpreting the same phrase. And then it says, B'lalei Shabbatot on Friday night. This is when rain would come. Maaseh bimei Shimon ben Shetach. There, something happened during the days of Shimon ben Shetach. And, there it is. There's our friend. For those who are Hebrew readers, bimei Shlomtzi Hamalka. And in the days of his sister, there she is, Shlomtzi Hamalka. What do we want to know about this time? Hayu kishamim yordim b'lalei Shabbatot ad shenasu chitin kichlayot usharim kigarinei azeitim. On and on and on and on. So here, she's back. I think that this might preserve an older tradition where you have her her, the great one mentioned, right? And then I think that Shlomzion becomes eclipsed by her more famous proto-rabbinic Pharisee brother. So this is a happy story. It's a little bit of a sad story. But here we have a remembrance of her name. And so if you teach this to your students, you know, don't use Tani, which is probably more read than Leviticus Rabbah, but she is mentioned, she's given credit during this time. It was such a time of divine favor. It was such a time of piety. And it was a piety that was restored by Shlomzion HaMelech and her brother, but mostly Shlomzion. Okay, so that's what I want to say about Shlomzion HaMelech. And I suppose, since I'm feeling very generous today, that I can stop and ask if there are any questions before we go to Berenike. All right, we are going to, Josephus a self-hating Pharisee? I do not think so at all. And I will take other questions at the end. For those who've heard me speak about Josephus in the past, you know I am a devout and staunch defender of Josephus. When it comes to his representation of Salome Alexandra, I would like to take him out to Starbucks and have a conversation about how to talk about women and their legacies. But I do not think that we need to at all treat Josephus, who holds the Roman Empire responsible in large part for what happened in the first century. I don't think that he was a self-hating Jew. We can, again, talk about that at the end of this hour. Let's talk about Berenike, another really unknown woman. In fact, probably even less known than Salome Alexandra. Now, Josephus really likes Berenike and respects her. It's the Romans who can't stand her. And they probably can't stand her for the same reason. I'm just going to say it. I think she's like the Meghan Markle of the ancient world. I think that the Romans feel very possessive of their male leaders and princes, and they don't like this outsider. I really should not talk about the British royal family. So forget Meghan Markle. The Romans felt that Berenike was beneath that she did not, she was not on his level. But let's go to Josephus's writings first to learn who Berenike is. Who is this mysterious princess? Let's learn about her. Okay, so do you see Berenike Antiquities, book 19? This is the very end because there are 20 books of Antiquities. Thank you, Deb. There are 20 books. This is the very end. And what does Josephus say? Now you're going to get some complicated family tree information. How are we doing for time? Terrible, as usual. Okay, so this is going to be a lot of fun / confusing. I want everyone to start making their mental flow charts. Claudius, remember King Claudius? Okay, comes after Gaius Caligula, and he's Caligula's uncle. He liberates Alexander the Alabarch. Alexander was a Jewish politician, but he works for the Roman Empire. So it might be misleading to say Jewish politician. He comes from Egypt, from Alexandria, and he's an officer who works for the Roman Empire, who had been imprisoned by his predecessor Caligula. And Claudius liberates him. Who's Alexander? Oh, okay. This is going to get very confusing. So now I do have to speak slow. The son of Alexander, I'll tell you Alexander is in a second, married Berenike. By the way, the son of Alexander is Marcus. Married Berenike, the daughter of King Agrippa, a Herodian king. Agrippa I, not Agrippa II, who's Berenike's brother. After Marcus dies, then Agrippa I, Berenike's father, marries Berenike to her uncle Herod, not the Herod, but a grandson of Herod. Okay. What do I want you to know from this? First of all, it's a small Jewish world and everyone's a cousin. But see, if I said that in person, people would be chuckling. It would be like a joke. But do you know, have we discussed Philo of Alexandria? I know that in the past, when I've taught for Torah in Motion, I've discussed Philo of Alexandria. So if you were in that class, you would know a little bit about Philo of Alexandria, who lived from around 20 BCE to 50 CE, and one of the great leaders of Alexandria, of the city, a philosopher who was not assimilated at all, who was a very devout observer of ancestral Jewish law, who happened to be in love with Stoic philosophy and try to read the scriptures allegorically through the lens of Hellenistic philosophy, but it would be wrong to talk about Philo as a Hellenized Jew. Philo. Okay, I need to get this right, so I have to slow down. Okay. Philo's older brother is the Alexander mentioned in this passage. And this is why I say it's a small Jewish world, because we have an Alexandrian Jewish family and a Jerusalem Jewish family who often visits Rome because they're very close with the Roman leaders. Alexander is Philo's older brother, and he works for the government of Rome in Egypt. He has a son, Marcus, who marries Berenike, which makes Berenike Philo's niece-in-law. Don't get stressed out. We do this at every Jewish wedding, right? Oh, you're married to my dog's neighbor's son, third cousin. And Alexander has a second son besides Marcus named Tiberius, who is a procurator of Judea and participates, is witness to a huge amount of unrest, anti-Jewish unrest in 38 AC in Alexandria. Okay. The Jews feel, why am I saying all this? First of all, it's interesting. Second of all, the Jews feel very, very, very ambivalent about this family, right? Because on the one hand, you have some of the most powerful, wealthy, civically engaged Jews that existed. Right? I'm trying to think of an example, but I don't want to use something anti-Semitic like the Rothschilds. But imagine like very, very, two very, very well-known families who are having this extremely powerful marriage. And doesn't last because Marcus dies young. And then Berenike marries her uncle, Herod, and then he dies young, or he, no, not young, but he dies shortly after they get married. Okay, now she is widowed twice and she's still a young woman. That's when she finds Titus. All right, so, and you have to appreciate the fact that these exploits somehow are not worthy of criticism. Josephus doesn't find them to be, you know, like salvagic and torsi. I love the all. Okay, let's go back to the sources. So Berenike is not only presented as a very charismatic, beautiful, elite, you know, wealthy young woman, but also extraordinarily pious. And during the time, in the early stages of the Jewish rebellion against the Roman Empire, Berenike is protected because she's elite, but she's also devastated at what's happening to her Judean kin. She's very loyal to the Jews of Judea and Jerusalem. And so Josephus describes Berenike's reaction to what's happening to the Jews in Jerusalem. And it's actually quite, quite moving, I think. So she witnesses with the liveliest emotion the outrages of the Roman soldiers, and she is sending her own bodyguards to the Roman prefect Florus to implore him, put a stop to the carnage. So she's using her power to try to convince the Romans to stop, killing Jews, please. But of course, they don't listen to her. They turn a deaf ear to her prayers, even though they know, you know, she's among the Jews. She's powerful. But this is just so stunning. The mad rage of the soldiers vented itself upon the queen. So she ends up being put at great risk for her life. Not only do they torture and they put their captives to death under her eyes. So they think, okay, maybe we can't kill her, but we can terrify her by killing bodyguards and others near her. But they would have killed her also had she not sought refuge in the palace, where she imagined this terrifying night that she has. She passes the night surrounded by guards, dreading an attack of the troops. So she puts herself in danger to beg Florus, the Roman prefect, to have pity on the Jews. And they're like, no, absolutely not. In fact, they kill, you know, a bunch of Jews in front of her, and she hastens away to a palace and imagine her just shaking through the night, terrified they're going to come for her. And not only was she so pious that she put herself at risk on behalf of the Jewish people, but she had happened to be in Jerusalem because she was discharging a vow to God. And so we're going to talk about that more later. What does that mean that she was discharging a vow to God? It was customary for those suffering from illness to make a vow to abstain from wine and to shave their heads. Was she a Nazirite? Was Berenike a Nazirite? We're going to see that this theme of making vows appears again in writings about Helena. But she had made a vow. I don't know if she shaved her head, but she made a vow. And so she was, that was culminating in her coming to Jerusalem. These rites Berenike was undergoing, and she would come barefoot before the tribunal and make supplication to Florus without any respect being shown to her, even at the peril of her life. So Josephus he's in awe of her. She's this pious woman. She's lives her life like a princess, could have been hiding away somewhere in a Roman villa, while there's carnage taking place throughout Judea and Jerusalem. But she goes to Jerusalem to discharge this vow. She sees what's going on, begs Florus to intervene, and she just barely escapes with her life. Now, the Roman writers are not as nice to Berenice. So Nazareth must let their hair grow, but I think that I think that he's saying to shave their heads during the 30 days preceding that. So I'm not sure if that means like at the end of the period of being a Nazarite. It's not clear. Kushner and Trump. All right, I got to read these later. It's not clear exactly what the situation is, and he does not use the word Nazir. Okay, let's look at some of our Roman writer friends. So Suetonius says that Titus, so he Suetonius writes little vignettes on each of the lives of Roman emperors, and he critiques Titus for riotous living. Now remember Vespasian, who's the general in 69 CE, and then in the middle of the war becomes emperor, has two sons, Titus and Domitian. And so Titus is initially a major player as a general in the war, but then he becomes ruler of the Roman Empire. Okay, and Titus protracts his revels until the middle of the night, and he has unchastity with male prostitutes and eunuchs. And by the way, don't forget his notorious passion for Queen Berenice, for whom it was even said that he promised marriage. Again, scandalous for a Roman prince to fall in love. Well, who knows if it was an emotional affair, but to promise marriage to this Judean queen, who maybe for the Jews was considered a hotshot, but for the Romans was still, she was still a Jew at the end of the day. She was not elite. She's not an elite Roman. And look, this is juxtaposed with all of his other bad boy behavior. He's consorting with male prostitutes and eunuchs and Berenice. Like, that's kind of the same thing. Thanks a lot, Suetonius. Now Juvenal portrays Berenice very critically and implies that she had a sexual relationship with her own brother, Agrippa too. There's no evidence of this. This would have just been libel. And in one of his satires, he says, an unnamed aristocratic woman bought herself a legendary diamond once given by the barbarian Agrippa to his incestuous sister to wear. Barbarian is a Greek word that means barbaros, bar. It just means someone who doesn't speak Greek. It means a foreigner. So again, the Jews are outsiders. They're not one of us. And they live right in the middle of everything, right? Judea is actually not, England was far away for the Romans, but Judea was right there. But the representation of Jews as outsiders, as coming from this sort of distant periphery of the kingdom, is a polemic that was very common in the first century. And here we have Agrippa, the incestuous barbarian, giving his sister a diamond. Tacitus is also very critical of this little affair between Titus and Berenice. Some believe that Titus even stopped vying at one point for control over the kingdom because he had to stop his military exploits and go hang out with Queen Berenice. The young man's heart was not insensible to Berenice, but his feelings towards her proved no obstacle to action. So at the end of the day, he got out of his love nest with Berenice and went back to work. We have him mentioned also, we have Berenice mentioned in Cassius Dio's Roman History, where the pressure, or I would say the critique, is disproportionately placed on Berenice, who expected incorrectly to marry him. By the way, I'm watching on Hulu the show Impeachment about Monica Lewinsky, and this reminds me how she was sort of demonized in the media as being the one who initiated the relationship. Berenice was at the height of her power and came to Rome along with her brother Agrippa. The latter was given the rank of praetor while she dwelt in the palace cohabiting with him. She wanted to marry him. She was acting all hoity-toity like his wife, but then he sent her away when he realized that this was not a popular match. And then she's mentioned again, ruling alongside her brother Agrippa too in Acts. I do want to say, I'm going to skip this because I would like to say a little bit of comments about Helena. But I want to point out first, there's a very famous Mishnah that is very affectionate to Agrippa. We think this is Agrippa II. It could have been Agrippa and Berenice's father, Agrippa I. But remember, this family, by the middle of the first century CE, they're both Hasmonean and Herodian. And Agrippa II and his sister Berenice probably did live as observant Jews. I mean, Josephus hints towards that, that she could have identified as an assimilated Jew or as a Roman, but she lives as an observant, pious Jew. And it seems like Agrippa, her brother, does as well. There's this beautiful image of him reading from a Torah scroll, reading a pasuk from Devarim that says you can't put a foreigner over you who's not your brother, who's not in there reading a real Jew. And he's crying and he's sobbing because Agrippa, he doesn't know if he's accepted. He doesn't know if he really is a fully legitimate Jew. And the rabbis comfort him and they say, you are our brother. You are our brother. So in the imagination, the memories of the rabbis, Agrippa may be Berenike, although we don't know, were considered pious leaders. Okay, so now maybe I'll just say one or two little, can someone refuse a Roman general or leader? It's a great question. I have no idea. But let's just say a little bit about Helena and then I'll wrap up. You have the source sheet and you can read Josephus's very interesting description of Helena of Adiabene and the conversion of her son to Judaism. There's just a few things that I want to point out here. So I'm just going to scroll down. We always talk about how it's not clear how one would have converted in the first century to Judaism, but Josephus's account of Helena's conversion is very edifying in this regard, because Josephus talks about two Jews, Hanania and Elazar, who are both trying to convert Helena's son, but they debate over how he should convert. Elazar says you have to circumcise in order to convert, and Hanania says to the son, Izatiz, you don't have to convert to be fully Jewish. And so embedded in the story, I think, is some really interesting evidence that the question of how to convert was maybe still under live debate in the first century. I think the last thing I want to say before we go to discussion is that the Mishnah in Sukkah makes reference to Helena building her own sukkah, but only according to rabbinic legislation, and also in such a way where she's represented as not knowing the halacha herself, but that she submits to the authority of the rabbi. So what was subject to great criticism in Josephus's writing, right, Salome Alexandra is improperly controlled or manipulated or taught by the rabbis. Here, we have a parallel description, but within the context of something very, very praiseworthy, that she is trying to build a sukkah, but needs the guidance of the rabbis to build that sukkah properly. And I think I'm going to end there. But I really encourage you to look at these sources on your own. And I guess I'll just, I always find myself saying, and one last thing, you do see common tropes. I didn't mention it, but there is a reference to Helena taking on a Nazirite vow in Josephus. And so we have many parallel themes in these three images, these three women. We have brother-sister teams because we have Agrippa II and Berenike, their brother-sister. We have Salome, and we have Shimon ben Shetach. We also have Helena and her husband, who happens to be her brother. We have stories about reading verses and crying. Agrippa reads in the Mishnah, he reads to very many cries. And if you look at Josephus, if you look at, it's in a Midrash at the very end of your source sheet, there's an image of Helena's sons reading Chumash and crying because they don't feel like they are fully legitimate converts, or they worry that they might not be. And there are themes of being controlled by men in all of these stories. And when you have these common tropes, it could be a sign that these are literary embellishments, not in all cases, because historically we know that Agrippa and Berenike are brother and sister. But when you have traveling tropes, let's say like the Nazirite vow, it could be a hint that there was an eye towards borrowing from some legends and using those to expand others. And with that, I'll stop because I'd love to hear from you. Any questions? I think most of what I'm seeing are comments or funny one-liners in the chat. I'm going to, as I always do, give you my email address, msimkovich at ctu.edu. You know, I think in a way this is more fun than reading Jewish literature about women, because these women were alive, they were real, they were in a way taken for granted, which is good. In other words, female leadership was not shocking or subversive or strange or controversial to the rabbis. It was just a fact of life. And I think that it would be ideal if we mainstreamed these women into our memories of this very important period. As queen, was Shlomit permitted to participate in ritual publicly? Shlom Tzion Malka. Yeah, I mean, I think so. Although we don't know the details of that ritual, but it's an interesting question. Did she like read the Torah? Did she perform hakel? I don't know. She assigns her son the position of high priest, so she does sort of mitigates her role, whereas her husband took on the role of high priest and expanded his role. Hard to know. How is Shimon ben Shetach the brother of, I don't know who AS is. You need to work me through your acronyms. Is that Salome Alexandra, S-A? No, that's just according to rabbinic legend. We can assume that that could be, but we don't have first century BC evidence of that. Ben Melech is raising his hand.
Yeah, how early do you date the Pharisees? Because you mentioned them, and it seems like they're even predate the Maccabees. Yeah,
we think early second century BCE. And Al Baumgarten has written very well on this, but the question of the origins of sectarianism is contested. We don't have evidence that it precedes the second century BCE.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Any other questions? Any other angst?
These queens, how deep into the temple could they venture? And could they venture deeper than a male king? And then the other question is, were they accorded the same respect in the temple? Because from Sanhedrin, we learn that the king was seated in a particular place, but not the king of other countries, if they were Jewish or, you know, non-Roman countries.
All I can tell you is that Josephus says over and over and over, she gives control to the Pharisees, which makes me intuit that she did not overstep her bounds in the temple. That's an intuition that I'm telling you based on the fact that she's empowering the Pharisees. And he criticizes her for mitigating that cultic role. I don't have any other evidence to answer that question in detail. It's a good question.
So was this the period that the Mishnah wrote about the Pharisees teaching the high priest what to do on Yom Kippur, and they cried and they cried? Is this that period?
I don't know how to date that legend. I don't know. It's a good question. All right. Hold on, I'm just going to, any good accessible books to read about any of these women? That is a question that I love. So there are some fantastic books, and I would start with the scholarship of Tal Ilan, T-A-L-I-L-A-N, who has written the book on Second Temple Women and Second Temple Judaism. Second Temple Women and Second Temple Judaism is not a good title of the book, but just Google that and you'll find her book. Thank you very much, and Chag Purim Sameach.
Wonderful. Somebody wrote so much information.
Great lecture.
At a time.
Great lecture. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks. Okay,
thank you so much.
Very good. Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you.
Happy Purim.
Thank you. Thank you.
How many
thank
people
you.
Are on here?
Let's say. 64.